Historian Lillian Thatcher Ulrich once said, "Well-behaved women rarely make history." Today, I'm going to tell you about two of these iconic women, rebels, visionaries, and rule breakers who refused to stay silent or sit still. From pirates to politicians, these women defied expectations, faced impossible odds, and still managed to leave a mark on history. Today's episode is all about Alice Roosevelt and Jeanne de Clisson. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. As always, I am your host, Kadra. If you're new to the show, hello and welcome. I tell tales every single week that have perplexed me. So if you love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more, don't worry, you're in the right place. And if you end up enjoying today's episode all about badass and scary women in history, I would love if you continue to follow along. If you are a returning listener, hello, my friends. Welcome back. I'm very happy you're here today. I have a double feature. We're going to be talking about two women that I loved so much learning about this week. I hope you guys enjoy it too. I do want to say thank you to B, my Perplexed Society member, who sent me a DM on Instagram, I think maybe a month or so ago, telling me about Alice Roosevelt. She inspired this episode. So thank you, B. And then also very quickly, I just wanted to welcome my newest Perplexed Society member. Welcome, Andrew. Andrew joined at tier 2, so he's going to unlock about 100 pieces of bonus content, and he's going to get access to my coverage of the Sons of Sam docuseries and the Epstein Files episode that I just released. I am going to be releasing more of those as well. So if any of that interests you or you want early and ad-free episodes, just looking for a way to support, go check out patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. Last announcement, and then we will dive right into today's story. I wanted to thank everyone who bought a Crushed Ice shirt. We just sent our first donation to the Defending Our Neighbors Fund, which helps support families get legal representation, get them out of these horrific situations that they're in. And we have donated $1,200. We are going to be donating more money once the shirts ship out. So just wanted to say thank you and update you guys. Your shirts should be arriving soon. I also have not gotten a shirt yet, but we were waiting for like the pre-sale to be done, and they have to be printed, handmade, shipped out, all that good stuff. And from what I've heard, we weren't really expecting this big of a turnout, which is absolutely amazing. So thank you. Thank you guys for doing that. And you can continue to get updates on social media if you are following Cryptid Cocktail Party. All of the sources that I used for today's episode will be available down in the show notes. So without further ado, let's get into today's episode all about badass women in history. Alice Roosevelt is arguably the most well-known and controversial first daughter of a U.S. president. She was commonly involved in scandals, she did not shy away from anything, and she was incredibly intelligent. She was nicknamed the Other Washington Monument. She was a socialite, a writer, headline maker, risk taker, and overall rabble rouser. She was a trendsetter during her time in the White House. And so let's get into the story of Alice Roosevelt. She was born to Theodore and Alice Roosevelt in their Manhattan, New York home at 6 West 57th Street. She was born on February 12, 1884, making her an Aquarius, and she was their first and only child. Her mother was a Boston banking heiress who was also named Alice. Theodore was a New York State Assemblyman at the time. Alice was a descendant of the Schuyler family, which was this prominent Dutch family in New York and New Jersey, whose descendants played a very critical role in the formation of the United States. They were like in the government, the military, all kinds of important things. And they were amongst the most influential New York dynasties at that time, like the Livingstons and the Clintons. But Alice Roosevelt's mother, Alice Hathaway Roosevelt, would pass away just 2 days after giving birth to Alice. Just 11 hours prior, Theodore Roosevelt's mother, Martha, had also just died. she passed from typhoid fever. It's believed that Alice Hathaway Roosevelt had been suffering from Bright's disease, inflammation of the kidneys, and the symptoms were likely masked due to her pregnancy. Alice's father, Theodore, was so overcome with grief, so heartbroken. He loved his wife so much. So the sight of his newborn daughter, he couldn't handle it. And so for a while, he actually sent his newborn daughter to live with his sister. Theodore hardly ever spoke of his wife again and omitted her entirely from his autobiography. So at this point, young Alice is living with her aunt, Anna, and Theodore went off to live on some ranch in North Dakota. Alice lived with her aunt, Anna, for several years in Manhattan. She spent a lot of her young child years alone and surrounded by books. So she very quickly became a bookworm. She was very well-read, very intelligent, and she was well-spoken. Then after her father remarried in December 1886 to Edith Kermit Caro, Alice moved back in with her father Theodore and her new stepmother. They were living at Sagamore Hill. 2 years later, she was joined by Edith and Theodore's first child, Theodore Jr. With her father's distance and her stepmother's coldness, Alice quickly became a very independent young lady. Edith once coldly told Alice that her biological mother was beautiful, but an insipid and childlike fool who would have, quote, bored Theodore to death if she were still alive. Which when I read this, I was like, oh my God, this is like the most wicked woman ever. How could you ever say that to your child? But Alice said in interviews later in her life that she had a lot of respect for Edith, despite her saying these things. So it sounds like they had a better relationship later on, but definitely complicated. Alice also remains very close with her aunt, Anna, lovingly referring to her as Auntie Bi. She said about her aunt later in life, quote, "There is always someone in every family who keeps it together. In ours, it was Auntie Bi." So Alice grew up with five half-siblings, Theodore III, Kermit, Ethel, Archie, and Quentin. The children spent their childhood years at Sagamore Hill and in Washington and New York, just depending on where their father's jobs dictated. At one point when Alice was a teenager, her father wanted to send her to this like very conservative boarding school, to which Alice said, quote, "If you send me, I will humiliate you. I will do something that will shame you. I tell you I will," end quote. So that should give you an idea of the kinds of things that Alice said. She was not afraid to stand up for herself to anyone, including her father. And that was, in fact, the end of the discussion. Theodore Roosevelt then became president in 1901. At this point, Alice Roosevelt was 17. President William McKinley had just succumbed to his wounds after being shot by an assassin. Alice became an overnight sensation with the public, nicknaming her Princess Alice. She was outspoken, drop-dead gorgeous, and dangerous. She was born to be in the spotlight, similar to her father. She once said about him, "He wants to be the bride at every wedding, the corpse at every funeral, and the baby at every christening." She didn't... sorry. She didn't play by the rules, which often resulted in her being on the front page of every tabloid. The color Alice Blue was also named after her for her gray-blue colored eyes. It became a really popular shade that the women started purchasing for their dresses and other garments. She also went on to inspire some songs, including the Alice Roosevelt March and the Alice Roosevelt Waltz. Young women were copying her dress, her habits, and the way she carried herself. People were naming their babies after her. Alice also publicly declared that she was pagan and called Christianity, quote, "sheer voodoo." She raced cars with unmarried men in the streets of Washington. She smoked cigarettes, including on the roof of the White House, after her father told her, "No daughter of mine will smoke under my roof." So she, in a classic smartass fashion, was like, okay, I won't smoke under your roof, I'll smoke on the roof. She would also stay out late partying. She went to tons and tons of parties, hundreds of them. She and her younger siblings were also known to wreak absolute havoc in the White House, sliding down the banisters and playing in the hallways on stilts. She made bets at sporting events and horse races. She commonly was accompanied by her green pet snake, who she fondly named Emily Spinach. She was also known to carry a copy of the Constitution in her purse. On May 11th, 1908, Alice amused herself in the Capitol's gallery at the House of Representatives by placing a tack on the chair of an unknown man. When the man sat on the tack, he, quote, "like the burst of a bubble on the fountain, like the bolt from the blue, like the ball from the cannon," shot up from his chair. And he looked around in surprise while Alice just giggled and looked away. So obviously behavior like this from a woman, especially in this time period, was not common and it was generally frowned upon. She had her critics, but by and large, Alice Roosevelt was very well-liked. Her supporters outweighed the critics. She was known to get tons and tons of fan mail, so much so, in fact, that the White House mailroom had to hire an extra receptionist just to sort through her mail. Theodore Roosevelt had men tell him that he needed to control his daughter, to which he would say, quote, "I can either run the country or I can attend to Alice, but I cannot possibly do both." Meanwhile, Alice served as an advisor to her father throughout his presidency. Theodore Roosevelt learned that he could leverage the authority of his office to help keep his daughter Alice out of trouble. He would call upon her on formal occasions, and he grew to value her political skills. So, yeah, sure, Alice was a little unhinged, but who among us? And she was a really good politician. She was smart, she knew how to get her points across, and she made people reconsider. After a successful political business trip in Puerto Rico, her father would say, quote, "You were of real service down there, and your presence was accepted as a great compliment." Then in 1905, Alice Roosevelt was involved in a large peace delegation in Asia regarding the Russo-Japanese War. She traveled with a group of male politicians all over. They went to Japan, China, Korea, and the Philippines. And this was unheard of. Alice held her own. She was the first daughter to ever act in this capacity. During the cruise to Japan, Alice jumped into the ship's swimming pool, fully clothed, and convinced one of the congressmen, William Burke Cochran, to join her. He said it looked like fun. She would end up meeting 16 U.S. presidents during her lifetime, and she's widely thought to be the person who met the most serving U.S. presidents in history. As for her romantic life, like everything else, Alice was known to make headlines. In 1906, she was briefly engaged to Nicholas Longworth III, and then they got married on February 17th. Longworth was from Ohio and a member of the Republican House of Representatives. He later became Speaker of the House. He was 14 years older than her, and he had a reputation of being the town playboy. Their wedding was the event of the season. They had more than 1,000 guests, and it has been known that this was the biggest and most impressive of all White House weddings. Alice made the first cut into their wedding cake with this gigantic sword that she borrowed from one of the military aides. Alice was also known to be non-monogamous, according to some sources. Other sources say she was unfaithful, which I think are two very different things. Not really sure what to make of that. But then there's also rumors that her husband, Nicholas Longworth, was sleeping around. She had a long list of lovers, allegedly, but her most public was her relationship with Senator William Borah from Idaho. When Alice later died, it was actually revealed her only child, a daughter named Paulina, was fathered by Borah. There was also some sources I read that she first considered naming her daughter Deborah, as in like Deborah, but thought that was a little on the nose and decided to change it to Paulina. Other sources say that her marriage was driven by Longworth's infidelity and alcoholism. But needless to say, their marriage definitely had complications, and they drifted apart during the 1912 election, especially because Alice basically stopped supporting her husband's Republican Party, and she was showing really strong support for her father's party, which was progressive. In 1909, the Roosevelt family was preparing to move out of the White House, and before their departure, Alice left a little parting gift, a voodoo doll of the new First Lady, Nellie Taft, in the front yard. That same year, at a school convention, a Los Angeles superintendent was complaining that Alice had influenced the entire nation to smoke cigarettes, calling it, quote, a demoralizing effect on the women of this country. Alice remained in the political sphere for the remainder of her life. She once told President Lyndon B. Johnson that the reason she wore wide-brimmed hats was so he could not kiss her. She publicly spoke out in the 1930s against her cousins, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. She criticized his attempts to combat the Great Depression, policies which were part of the New Deal. Alice's home became a magnet for anti-New Dealers. This was around the time that Alice, like many other Americans, was struggling financially. She was appearing in tobacco advertisements to earn money, and she published her first autobiography. The book was called Crowded Hours, and it received rave reviews. Alice also gained a seat on the National Board of Directors of America First, an organization devoted to maintaining U.S. neutrality during World War II until Pearl Harbor. Alice was very fond of Richard Nixon as well. They had a really wonderful friendship. She supported him throughout his campaign in 1960 against Kennedy and his 68 run against Humphrey. She was not afraid to speak her mind. She was well remembered for saying, quote, "If you can't say something good about someone, sit right here by me." So I think it's clear Alice loved to say her piece. This became such a famous quote from Alice that she actually got it embroidered on a pillow that sat at her tea table. In 1955, Alice began to have health complications. She fell and broke her hip, and 1 year later, she was actually diagnosed with breast cancer and had to have a double mastectomy. She also later joked that she was the only topless woman in the White House. Throughout her adulthood, Alice had a complicated and distant relationship with her daughter, Paulina. However, Alice was close with her granddaughter, Joanna, who she later raised after Paulina died in 57 from an overdose of sleeping pills. Alice remained close with Richard Nixon during this time as well, who was a pallbearer at Paulina's funeral. Nixon later would say about Alice that she was, quote, "the most interesting conversationalist of the age. No one, no matter how famous, could ever outshine her," end quote. Which makes me think about that question people ask sometimes. If you could meet with anyone, like have dinner with them alive or dead, who would you meet with? And I feel like having dinner with Alice Roosevelt would be so memorable. For 6 decades, Alice Longworth hosted a salon at her DuPont Circle home, exchanging views and striking deals with powerful men. She would regularly meet with scientists, authors, conservationists, diplomats, and politicians from all different persuasions. During her 1969 interview with 60 Minutes, when she was 85 years old, she told America exactly what she thought about just about every president from the 20th century. She called Warren Harding probably the most inferior man, and Benjamin Harrison a, quote, "little squat man with a beard." Alice was controversial, but her exponential knowledge of human nature and resiliency earned her the respect of the coveted position of presidential advisor for most of her life. Her position in D.C. was very unique. She had friends in every department, in every office. Alice was so well-liked, she was encouraged to run for her husband's seat after he died. She also had a newspaper column, and readers suggested that she could one day become the first female vice president or president. But Alice opted out of this. She preferred her political practices to be more behind the scenes. Alice was once quoted saying, "I submit to you that one of the difficult things we have going on in the United States of America today is the fact that our legislators don't talk to one another." She believed that the only way to get things done was to reach hands across the aisle. She died on February 20th, 1980, a few days after her 96th birthday, due to complications from emphysema and pneumonia. Alice, to date, is the longest living child of a U.S. president. She's buried in the Rock Creek Cemetery in Washington, D.C. In an official statement marking her death, President Jimmy Carter said, quote, "She had style, she had grace, and she had a sense of humor that kept generations of political newcomers to Washington wondering which was worse, to be skewered by her wit or to be ignored by her." End quote. So that, everybody, is the story of Alice Roosevelt. And I gotta say, pretty iconic. Our second badass woman in history takes us over to Europe. This is the story of Jeanne de Clisson. Born in 1300 into French nobility, this woman has become known as a noblewoman, a wife, a mother, and a terrifying pirate. She raised a fleet of ships that terrorized the French and led an army for over a decade. Not much is known about Jeanne's early life. She was born in the village of Belleville-sur-Vie to parents Maurice Montagu and Laetus de Parthenay. Her father died when she was just 3 years old. Jeanne got married to her first husband, Geoffrey de Chateaubriant VIII, when she was just 12 years old, which was even young for that time period. Geoffrey was 19. They had two children and they were married for 14 years. She became a widow in 1326. 2 years later, she married Guy of Penthievrey. I'm sorry if I'm butchering these names. I don't speak French. The marriage didn't last and it was annulled in 1330. Turns out Guy was lined up to marry someone else, Marie de Blois, Philip IV of France's niece. So Guy remarried. Jeanne's third marriage is what would go on to lead her to infamy. Jeanne met Olivier de Clisson IV, a wealthy Breton nobleman. He owned property in Chateau de Clisson, Nantes, and Blaine. This land combined with properties that Jeanne already owned, and this made them a major power couple. They had five children. It's likely their marriage was a rare love match as well, because at the time that they met, Jeanne was still married to her first husband, and Olivier was married to his first wife. It's likely their first child, their daughter, Isabeau, was illegitimate. It's quite rare during this time period to hear stories of a love match. Marriages were arranged based on like royalty and assets, but by all accounts, Jeanne and Olivier were very much in love. They had a very happy marriage. To understand the historical significance of this story, we have to briefly talk about the 100 Years' War. During this time, Brittany was self-governing. The land was contested, and there would be a series of major conflicts between England and France from 1337 to 1453. Edward III of England claimed he was the rightful heir to the French throne. Then the Duke of Brittany, John III, died, and it was unclear who would become his heir. The options were the Duke's half-brother, Jean de Montfort, Guy Penthievre's daughter from another marriage, Jean's ex-husband, if you remember, and Jean de Penthievre. This led to some drama, basically all of these men fighting for who's going to be the heir, and the English overall supported Jean de Montfort, while the French supported this guy, Charles de Blois. Jeanne de Clisson and her husband Olivier publicly supported Charles, but for whatever reason, the French crown came to believe that Olivier had betrayed France. They believed that he was supporting people from England, and everyone was just battling for fame and fortune. They're fighting over land. It was very messy, and the fight was so epic, so complicated, it ultimately went on to inspire the hit TV series Game of Thrones. So if you're not really following the drama so far and you've seen Game of Thrones, just imagine that. That is what was happening. And eventually, the English did this land siege in the town of Vannes, and the city fell. During this siege, Jeanne de Clisson's husband and the love of her life, Olivier, was captured. Olivier was eventually freed, but shortly after this, he got arrested again, along with a couple other nobles. They were at this tournament, and they were celebrating England and France's newly supposed truce. So they show up under false pretenses, they get invited to this tournament, and they're like, yeah, it's going to be like all these English people and French people, and it's just like a peaceful hangout. And then him and all these guys got arrested, and they were like, what the hell is going on? Why are we getting arrested? He had accepted this invitation along with 14 other minor lords, but it was all a lie. So under this false white flag of peace, on August 2nd, 1343, Olivier de Clisson, Lord of Brittany, a knight, and presumed defender of the king, was tried for treason. Convicted on no evidence but a coerced confession, and then he was beheaded along with his comrades. His body was then grotesquely displayed in Paris. His head was sent to be displayed in Nantes, an act usually reserved for low-class criminals, never members of nobility. So this was a huge deal. And obviously, Jeanne de Clisson was beside herself. As the record states, quote, "And there on a scaffold had his head cut off. And then from there, his corpse was drawn to the gibbet of Paris and there hanged on the highest level. And his head was sent to Nantes in Brittany to be put on a lance over the Sauvetout gate as a warning to others." End quote. So this is the point where Jeanne became rageful. She wanted revenge. She was never the same again. And she took her sons to Nantes after Olivier was murdered and made them get a good look at their father's decapitated head. She also told them that King Philip VI and Charles de Blois were responsible for their father's death. So she swears her revenge, and the rest is history. Jeanne sold all of her husband's land and assets and declared she was going to war. She raised an army of other French people, people who had always loved and respected Olivier, and together they set out on a siege against the French. Their first target was Château de Tafaux, one of Charles de Blois' strongholds. The attack was unexpected to them, and it was extremely successful. They also intentionally, and they would go on to do this each time they attacked someone, they left a few people alive so that those people could spread the word of what Jeanne de Clisson was doing and so that people would grow to fear her. She cut her hair short and she wore red during her raids. This led to another one of Jeanne's nicknames, the Red Lady. Jeanne continued to travel throughout France, recruiting more fighters. On December 1st, 1343, King Philip VI formally declared open season on Jeanne. The French Navy gave her their full attention. Still, it would be years before they finally tracked her down. Jeanne continued attacking ships that were loyal to King Philip VI, and piracy for most during this time period was about getting riches, going on these exotic adventures. But for Jeanne, she was driven by sheer rage, a burning need for retribution. In 1346, long after Parliament's declaration, English and French forces would clash at the Battle of Crecy. Jeanne de Clisson arrived with her black fleet, all of her ships she had painted black and they had red sails, and she eluded capture. In 1348, the French Navy caught up with the black fleet again, but Jeanne refused to give up until almost all of her pirate fleet was dead. Finally, the French sailors boarded her ship, making their way to the captain's cabin, but Jeanne de Clisson had eluded capture. While the French fleet was making its way through the ship's interior, Jeanne, her sons, and a crew member of six pirates had escaped on a tiny boat, heading out into the open English Channel. For 6 days, the boat drifted through freezing waters as the passengers got sicker and sicker. They had no food, no water, their wet clothes were freezing in the winter air, and finally, at some point in their desperate escape, Jean's youngest son, Guillaume, died. After 7 days adrift, the crew finally landed. Jean then teamed up with King Edward III and officially became a pirate. Edward gave Jean resources and money to buy 3 ships. The ships were once again painted black, the sails red. This became the Black Fleet, and her flagship was known as My Revenge. For the next few years, starting when she was around age 40, Jean's Black Fleet ruthlessly attacked French ships, murdering everyone on them except for a few people, all in the name of spreading the word of her attacks. According to rejectedprincesses.com, for years, Jean haunted France, quote, leaving only corpses and ash in her wake, their own homegrown boogeyman. The rumors only grew. No one could catch her, no one could kill her, no one could stop her, end quote. Jean also helped the English during the Hundred Years' War, becoming an ally. Jean murdered on the high seas for 13 years, the same amount of years that she had been married to Olivier. She continued after the death of the King of France and the same king who had Olivier executed. However, Charles de Blois lived for another 8 years, so perhaps Jean had grown tired of war after the 13 years and wanted to finally return to a quiet life because she settled down after 13 years of piracy and murder. Jean then remarried. She met an English knight and a military deputy of King Edward III named Sir Walter Bentley. They lived out their days in a castle in Brittany, and she later died there at the age of 59. Her fourth husband, Walter, died just a few weeks later.
It is believed that Jean's ghost haunts the Chateau de Clisson,
where she and her husband, Olivier, spent many happy years together before he was executed. Jean de Clisson's legend has continued to be told throughout the centuries, being a cautionary tale to everyone. There is nothing deadlier than a woman wronged. And that, everybody, is the perplexing story of Jean de Clisson in today's episode about badass women in history. Thank you guys so much for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed these stories of Alice Roosevelt and Jean de Clisson. I just think there is something so interesting about women who defy social norms and expectations. It seems like Alice was a very smart woman. She was clearly very well accomplished. Jean de Clisson, her story is just heartbreaking and terrifying. There's something really fascinating about it to me. So I'm curious what you guys think about these stories down below. And again, I apologize for butchering all these French pronunciations. I like telling stories from around the world, but I always get nervous when I'm saying the names, so I hope I didn't upset or trigger anyone. But let me know what you guys think, and just continue to follow along and support the show. That's always much appreciated. If you haven't done so yet, please leave a 5-star review wherever you listen or wherever you don't listen. Like, you could go over on Apple Podcasts or go over on Spotify. That really, really helps. That's how I get new listeners. If you want to support the show further, you can always check out the support links down in the show notes. Patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast is where you can get bonus content, early ad-free episodes, including my Epstein Files episode and my Sons of Sam docuseries episodes that are dropping right now. You all are amazing. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe, and I will talk to you next week. Bye!
Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast, is hosted, written, and produced by me, Kadra Brannon. This show is proud to be a part of the Black Cat Network. Assistant editor is Charlie Leopold. Theme song by Patrick Thompson. All music used in this episode is from Pixabay. If you like the show, be sure to share it with others and leave a 5-star rating and review. Contact, support, and merch links can be found in the episode description. To unlock early ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus content, join the Perplexed Society at patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. Listener stories, topic requests, and business inquiries can be submitted to perplexitymysterypodcast.com or emailed to perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail.com. Until next week, stay curious.